From NPR News, this is Weekends on All Things Considered. I'm Guy Raz.
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
Tuesday night, President Obama delivers his second State of the Union address before Congress. Our cover story this Sunday is in three parts: what the president will say, what some policy experts hope he says, and how the Republicans plan to respond. First, to the what. And for that, we turn to Peter Baker, White House correspondent for The New York Times. Peter, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
In recent months, as you know, the president has likened our current situation to a new Sputnik age, a sort of a turning point where America will have to confront a whole series of consequential challenges. Is that the theme he's likely to strike on Tuesday night?
I think you'll hear a lot of that idea, the idea of making America competitive again in the world, that the risk of falling behind our competitors like China and India in particular is too great not to find ways of improving America's posture. And that includes a lot of different things that President Obama considers to be priorities, not just trade, which is an obvious one, but things like education, how to get our workforce better trained, research, innovation, infrastructure, high-speed trains, that kind of thing.
Are you going to be looking for clues in what the president is expected to say in Bill Clinton's 1995 State of the Union, a similar situation? He had to face a newly elected Republican House of Representatives. I mean, do you think that will sort of give us a sense of where President Obama might be headed, at least with his rhetoric?
I think we will. I think we've begun to see, in small ways anyway, a repositioning of where he is at. That's not to say he's given up on the things he really cares about. He's still going to defend the health care overhaul against Republican efforts to repeal it. He's still going to defend the things he did in terms of stimulus, financial regulation, and so forth. But you hear him talking more about trade, which wasn't a big theme in his first year, for instance. You hear him this week appointing a new competitiveness council headed by Jeffrey Immelt, the chief executive of GE, reaching out to the business community in different ways.
He's got Bill Daley as the new chief of staff and Jacob Lew, these sort of pro-business guys around him now.
Exactly, and he promised to look at regulations that hobbled job creation. Mm. So you're hearing a little bit of a recognition that he needs to work out a new relationship with business.
There is this perception, of course, that he is his administration
right.
has been anti-business.
Right.
Do you think this speech will be an effort to kind of mend those ties?
I do think that's part of it, absolutely. He's going to say, look, this is too important for all of us to fracture over old lines of pro and anti-business.
Peter, you have covered Washington for a long time. You've seen these moments nearly every January when the president goes to address Congress. How much does it set the tone for the year ahead?
I think it does set a tone. The State of the Union is important because it's an organizing document for a presidency. It's not just a speech he writes a couple days in advance. It's something that goes through a process over weeks and weeks leading up to the speech in which the whole of government comes together and says, what are we going to make our priority? So what gets in the State of the Union and what doesn't get in the State of the Union is really a proxy fight for what the whole year is going to be about for an administration.
All right, Peter, we know you are well connected. You got deep sources. Give us some surprises. Any surprises?
Well, I think if I knew them, they wouldn't be surprised. I think an interesting parlor game on Tuesday night will be to count the number of times you hear the word jobs and hear the number with the word competitiveness. What you probably won't hear, for instance, would be words like Iraq, Afghanistan, and it'll be interesting to see the applause lines. What is the applause line? Part of what happened in 2010 was he came right off the election of Scott Brown in Massachusetts, and he basically came back and said, I don't give up easily. Don't think you're going to roll me. This time around, having had a relatively successful lame duck session, the imperative is a little different. I think he has to find a way of asserting his strength, but also making himself look reasonable to the broader public so that if there are fights to come, he looks like the good guy and the other guys don't.
That's Peter Baker. He's a White House correspondent for The New York Times. Peter, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Now, imagine if you could give that speech. Well, we asked three top policy experts to deliver their own dream version of the State of the Union. We'll hear from Maya McGinnis. She's the president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget at the New America Foundation. Also from Bruce Bartlett, a former domestic policy advisor to President Ronald Reagan. And Heather Hurlburt, a former special assistant to President Bill Clinton, who's now with the National Security Network. We begin with Maya McGinnis.
We all know that our deficits are too large. We cannot continue to borrow beyond our means without facing dire economic consequences. For the past few years, my primary focus has had to be on fixing the economy. And though we're not out of the woods yet, we must now turn our attention to getting our nation's fiscal house in order. Controlling the debt affects everything I and we all care about, including providing our children a first-rate education, investing in the technologies of the future, protecting the most vulnerable, and building a competitive business environment. Every one of those national priorities is at risk until we right our fiscal ship. If we lose control of our debt, we lose control of our destiny. So tonight, I invite the leadership from the House and the Senate to join me for a budget retreat, where we will work until we come up with a bipartisan plan to bring down the debt. This will not be easy, but we must put behind us finger-pointing and political posturing and solve this problem. I will not consider my work complete until we pass a plan to do so.
That's Maya McGinnis. Now to former Reagan advisor Bruce Bartlett.
There is almost universal agreement that the tax code is a mess. It is cluttered with a vast number of special tax provisions that benefit neither the economy, society, nor the Treasury. Worse, these provisions, called tax expenditures, may even hinder growth by encouraging individuals and businesses to invest their time and money inefficiently. Economic decisions ought to be based on fundamentals, not because the tax code provides a subsidy for doing one thing rather than another. It is clear that one reform will have to be a reduction in tax rates on American businesses, which are handicapped by one of the higher corporate tax rates among major countries. But this must not be the beginning and end of tax reform. Cleaning up the code and getting rid of special deals for particular businesses and industries is just as important as cutting rates. Furthermore, the package must be balanced. We can't afford another big tax cut, and any tax bill that is not paid for will meet my veto pen.
Former Reagan advisor Bruce Bartlett, and finally, to former Clinton advisor Heather Hurlburt.
My fellow Americans, as president, I hear every day from the most respected, least partisan institution in our national life, the U.S. military. Our men and women in uniform are asking for civilian leadership that goes beyond bickering. You might be surprised, and we can all be inspired by what they have to say about the core issues we face, like clean energy, debt reduction, and economic competitiveness. The military is asking us not to wait to make investments in clean energy and green jobs. So the Pentagon isn't waiting. It's researching next-generation fuels, putting wind farms on Army bases, and solar arrays on Air Force hangars. Surely we in Washington can do the same.
Heather Hurlburt speaking, and before, we heard from Bruce Bartlett and Maya McGinnis. Now, Republicans in Congress plan to launch a debate on spending the very day President Obama set to deliver his speech. Ohio Congressman Jim Jordan's spearheading that conversation. Congressman Jordan, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you.
You're proposing cuts that over the next 10 years, you say, could amount to about $2.5 trillion in savings. I wonder why you think your plan is better or more substantial than the plan put forward by the bipartisan Simpson-Bowles Commission back in December. That proposal would cut $4 trillion over that same period.
Well, a couple things. One, theirs has tax increases in it, and we just don't accept the premise that, you know, somehow you need to raise taxes to deal with deficits and debt. Deficits and debt are caused by government spending. And the other thing that we think is critical is to truly deal with the amount of debt we now have, you've got to have economic growth. And to have economic growth, you can't be raising taxes on the job creators.
Congressman Jordan, your plan makes cuts primarily in non-defense discretionary spending. Mm-hmm. I counted about 50 programs. Mm-hmm. As you know, most deficit hawks, including Ronald Reagan's former budget director, David Stockman, who said on this program, he said you can't cut the budget deficit substantially without going after entitlement programs like Medicare and Social mm-hmm. Security. Are you intentionally sort of skirting around touching those two very sensitive programs?
No, I said today, Guy, and it's a good question. Does everything need to be on the table? Certainly. We need to look at the entitlements. We need to look at making sure that we protect and save Social Security. And in order to do that, you're going to have to make some changes. We need to make sure we protect and save Medicare. In order to do that, you're going to have to make some changes. So certainly those need to be a part of the discussion as well.
You say changes to entitlement programs like Medicare and Social Security. But, let's, talk frankly. I mean, changes is going to mean cuts, some kind of cuts.
Certainly, people at or near retirement age should be able to stay in the exact same system because they've structured and built their lives around that model. But for younger Americans, we need to begin to make some changes and empower them and their family to do something different that will protect the systems going forward and, frankly, empower them and their family as they also move to the future.
Many of the programs that are proposed to be cut are pale in size and scope to the large entitlement programs or defense spending. For example, there's a proposal to cut the U.S. Agency for International Development. This is an agency that many foreign policy experts would argue is the tip of the spear of America's soft power diplomacy. These are programs to, you know, educate the world about the good things that the United States does. I mean, wouldn't the elimination of a program like USAID have some serious national security consequences?
It may, in fact, have. Who knows? But let's have the debate. Here's the point. The bulk of our savings in this bill comes because we reduce overall spending. We now have to go through and do the hard analysis program by program, line item by line item, and say, okay, is this wasteful? Is this redundant? Does this program work? So maybe you're right on that particular program, but I think it's important to include it in the discussion and move forward so that we can get to real savings.
The Senate Democrats say this plan probably will never pass the Senate. Where could you see daylight with the other side, with Democrats?
You know, I don't know. See, I just – people said the same thing with this, you know, the health care repeal that we did. I mean, I always use the analogy, you know, every Friday night in the fall, we have football games in Ohio and across this country. And many times there's one team that's heavily favoring all the underdog. There's no way they can win. They still kick the ball off. They still play the game. I think we have to do what we told the voters we were going to do, send it over to the next body and see what happens.
That's Ohio Congressman Jim Jordan, chairman of the Republican Study Committee. That's the conservative caucus in the House of Representatives. Congressman, thank you.
Thank you, Guy. Take care.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. President Obama visited a General Electric plant today in Schenectady, New York. He saw, as he said, high-tech steam turbines and all kinds of fancy stuff. But the main focus was jobs. The president was joined by the head of GE, Jeffrey Immelt, who will lead a new advisory board on job creation in the private sector. NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
As he toured the GE plant in Schenectady, New York today, Mr. Obama saw signs workers had put up showing where the gas turbines they were building would eventually go. The company ships turbines to Kuwait and Saudi Arabia. And under a new contract, GE sending $750 million worth of generators to Samalkot, India.
Most of you hadn't heard of Samalkot. But now you need to know about it because you're going to be selling to Samalkot, India. And that new business halfway around the world is going to help support more than 1,200 manufacturing jobs and more than 400 engineering jobs right here in this community because of that sale.
Hoping that other companies might learn from GE's success, Mr. Obama named the company's chief executive officer, Jeffrey Immelt, to lead a new president's council on jobs and competitiveness. The panel replaces an earlier advisory board led by former Federal Reserve Chairman Paul Volcker. In making the switch, Mr. Obama signaled that while the U.S. economy has begun to recover, it's still not adding jobs fast enough to replace the millions that were lost during the deep recession.
The past 2 years were about pulling our economy back from the brink. The next 2 years, our job now is putting our economy into overdrive.
It's doubtful Congress will approve any more big spending measures by the government, so the president is asking the advisory board to focus on ways to encourage hiring and investment by the private sector. Many U.S. companies have been sitting on cash instead of hanging out the help wanted sign. In an op-ed column for the Washington Post today, GE's Immelt wrote the jobs panel will explore opportunities to boost manufacturing and exports. As he told workers in Schenectady, those are both areas Immelt knows something about.
We're a big exporter. 90% of all the products made in this facility are exported outside the United States. So it's really a great example, I think, of what we want to do to really renew this country and this company.
Immelt's appointment represents another olive branch from the administration to the U.S. business community. The Chamber of Commerce offered cautious praise for the pick, citing Immelt's business experience and his understanding of global markets. But the Alliance for American Manufacturing, which includes the Steelworkers Union, called Immelt a poor choice to lead the advisory panel, pointing to his opposition to Buy American policies. The White House notes that GE has created new manufacturing jobs in the U.S., even as the company also invests in plants overseas. The company reinvests about 6% of its revenues in research and development. President Obama says that commitment to innovation is crucial to the economy's long-term success.
We're going back to Thomas Edison's principles. We're going to build stuff and invent stuff.
The new advisory panel is tasked not only with encouraging job growth in the short run, but also boosting America's global competitiveness. Those are likely to be big themes for the president in next week's State of the Union address and for the next 2 years of the Obama administration. Scott Horsley, NPR News, The White House.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. Today, President Obama said he wants to open up Chinese markets to U.S. companies to have two-way trade, not just one-way trade. Many of those companies are in the Midwest, which may explain why Chinese President Hu Jintao wrapped up his high-profile U.S. visit today in Chicago. Here's NPR's Cheryl Corley.
President Hu began his day with a visit to Chicago's Walter Payton High School, home to the Confucius Institute. In a partnership with public schools, the institute teaches about 12,000 students Mandarin Chinese. Alex Girovich, a sophomore who started taking Mandarin last year, was one of the lucky ones on hand for the president's visit.
It's weird thinking that the president of China picked our school out of all the schools in the United States to go to, but it's cool.
Students from several schools waved Chinese and American flags and welcomed Hu in his native tongue. They treated him to performances, including a traditional Chinese handkerchief dance. President Hu thanked the students and invited the school district to send 20 teachers and students to China. Then he left to tour an expo of companies with ties to China to show the growing cooperation between that country and the United States. Last night at a formal dinner for Hu, Mayor Daley said it was a relationship that will endure.
Our long-range goal is to make Chicago the most China-friendly city in the United States and to establish it as China's gateway to America's.
The mayor has traveled to China several times in recent years, cultivating relationships and promoting the city. Chicago has sister city relationships with two Chinese cities. Speaking through an interpreter during the dinner, President Hu said there's been a substantial increase in the number of exports from Midwestern states since 2000.
Boeing, Motorola, Caterpillar, McDonald's, and many other well-known companies have become household names in China.
This was the first time President Hu visited Chicago, and last night a crowd of supporters rallied across the street from his downtown hotel. Student Ping Ting Li had traveled from downstate Illinois in hopes of getting a glimpse of Hu.
We're coming here for just say, I love China, nothing else, no politics. We love our president, we love China. Yeah.
But another crowd wasn't offering support and criticized China for the way it handles human rights. Many of those shouting shame on the Chinese president were of Tibetan descent. Pumsak Doji, who had traveled from Minnesota, said talk about trade deals shouldn't dominate the conversation with China's leader in town.
They consider the human right is not a big deal, but the trade deal is the biggest deal. That's actually not a fair deal. The fair deal is the human right is the fair deal, is the biggest deal.
But the focus throughout the Chinese president's trip was on business. While he was visiting the Confucius Institute and talking to Chinese businesses located in the Midwest, China's commerce minister was in Chicago, too. At a forum promoting U.S.-Chinese economic cooperation, a contract signing ceremony was held for ventures between dozens of U.S. and Chinese companies. Cheryl Corley, NPR News, Chicago.
President Hu's visit this week fueled a long-running debate about whether China's economic rise is a threat or an opportunity. It's not the first time America has faced an Asian challenge to its economic dominance. But as NPR's John Itzde reports, U.S. attitudes toward an emerging Asian competitor appear to have moderated.
A generation ago, it was Japan's powerful economic rise that was troubling Americans. A movie based on Michael Crichton's novel Rising Sun captured the mood.
You ever negotiated with the Japanese before?
This is hardly a negotiation.
What is it then?
It's a homicide.
The movie was a murder mystery that stoked lots of fears about Japanese investment in U.S. industries. Michael Dimmock of the Pew Research Center says in the late 1980s and early 90s, Americans had a much darker view of Japan than the current view of China.
Japan was more uniformly vilified, or at least a broader concern for Americans in the late 80s and early 90s than China is today.
Comparisons of polling data support that conclusion. For instance, back in the early 1990s, more than 30% of Americans said Japan posed the biggest threat to the United States of any country. Only 20% say that about China today. In purely economic terms, almost 70% of Americans thought Japan was taking advantage of the U.S. through unfair trade 20 years ago. That compares to 55% who think that about China today. That's still a significant number, says Dimmock. But he says the sentiment toward China is more nuanced.
There's a sense that China's trade policies are unfair. But at the same time, a majority tells us that they want us to build a stronger relationship with China, that China seems essential to America's economic future.
Nearly 60% of Americans hold that view. So why do Americans take a more relaxed view toward China's emergence as an economic power?
Two reasons. One is that Japan came first.
That's Professor Ellis Krauss, who's an Asia specialist at the University of California, San Diego.
Japan really was the first big competitor to the U.S. after World War II, and that really shocked, I think, many Americans. But I think the more fundamental reason is that Japan and China's pattern of economic development has been very different.
Japan grew largely on its own by keeping out foreign direct investment and building a powerful export machine. China has built an export machine, too, but it's welcomed outside investment and the participation of foreign companies in its economy. In fact, much of what it exports is produced for those companies. Also, the products Japan exported were very visible and important to Americans, including much better cars and televisions than America was producing back then. Professor Krauss says Americans also felt threatened by Japanese purchases of iconic U.S. companies and real estate.
You know, the buying of Rockefeller Center and Columbia Pictures, of course, were the most symbolic of those.
Memories of World War II also added to negative views of Japan. After all, there were still many Americans alive who had fought Japan or lost loved ones in the war. Ellis Krauss says military issues will likely sour American views toward China, too, as that nation expands its navy and adds muscle to its air power.
Americans are beginning to wake up to the fact that China is not democratic and China is not a military ally of the U.S., both of which Japan was.
While predictions that Japan would overtake the U.S. never materialized, virtually everyone believes China will eventually surpass the U.S. as the world's largest economy. John Idstey, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.